Hello and welcome to another episode of the CG Garage featuring our good friends from Steel Blue. Lon, you introduced me to them. They're really cool guys. I actually went over to San Francisco for GDC and I decided to stop by their office and talk to them. But tell me a little bit, or tell our audience a little bit, about Steel Blue.
Yeah, it's a architectural visualization firm up in San Francisco. Mm-hmm. I had the distinct pleasure working with some of those guys in a former life, and they've grown to be an amazing firm up there, doing a lot of big work, like the giant Salesforce Tower. I think that's the biggest lease in San Francisco history. So they were doing some of the renderings of that.
Yeah. I think the Ferry Building as well.
The Ferry Building.
Right.
But they're also doing some incredible work in VR now.
What's interesting is, so the people we talked to is Eric Altman, who you know very well, obviously, O'Brien Chalmers, and Mike Brown, who they affectionately called Downtown Mike Brown. But super great guys. This is the thing that's the most fascinating to me about it. A lot of people are out there trying to figure out, how are we going to turn VR into a business? What can we do to make money in VR? But these guys and the architecture world in general, they're not the only example, but they're a good example, are the guys who basically have been doing this for 2 years and making money off VR for
doing it.
And this is all they do. This is a big part of their business. And so while a lot of people are out there trying to figure out, what is it that's important about VR? What are people... The architecture world is already 2 years ahead of everyone else. Yeah. I really believe it.
Just makes sense.
It does. And I think it's a little bit like global illumination back in the day. A lot of people were like, maybe we'll introduce global illumination to visual effects. And meanwhile, architects have been doing it for 15 years, right? And it's not that they're particularly advanced. It's just that it serves a very specific need, right?
Yep.
And so, for example, let's talk about this, because not a lot of people know what an architecture firm does, or an architecture visualization firm. These guys are dealing with huge, very expensive pieces of property, right?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it could be, hundreds of millions of dollars for a building going up. Or right. Billions of dollars even for, some massive stuff around the world. So there's a lot of investment tied into it, and there's a lot of need to put visuals out there, whether it's to lease space or pre-lease space, or to even get funding from the bank in order to make the projects happen. And that happens throughout the life cycle of a project, right? So you may do different things at different times. So if you're trying to, sell somebody a condo, you might show them what that might look like in virtual reality, or if you're trying to move somebody into a new office space, you show them that whole suite of tools. So,
or you're buying some, multi-million dollar condo, you just see it in VR and you can pick your paint colors and stuff like that.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right. And so these guys do that. I mean, it was amazing. I was walking around their office while everyone's like, we'll see if we can turn this into a business. They have boxes and boxes of Gear VRs to just hand out to clients, all ready to go, presentations, and this is done. And so this is just one step. Obviously, they're looking at the next steps, 6 degrees of freedom and all those other things. These guys really figured it out. I think it's very, very important for people that are trying to understand VR, trying to figure this out, to realize that they should look at companies like Steel Blue and say, this is the companies we will learn from in terms of best practices, I think. So it's a really cool thing. A couple of announcements that we should probably make. One is V-Ray for Rhino.
Yeah, right? It's here.
It's here. V-Ray for Rhino 3. And a lot of new stuff in there. Actually, you know what? I really liked the video we did of that.
Yeah, it's a good little story. Makes sense.
Good. And there's so much going on and so much new. This is far, far, far advanced from the last V-Ray version that you may have used. And it's got an enormous amount of features that I think a lot of people in that world will enjoy, which is very closely tied to the SketchUp when we did a week or two ago, right?
Yeah. I mean, the user interface is kind of shared between it. The idea is that it's as simple as can be, right? That's one of the kind of key things for that package, is to make it easy so that it's almost transparent when you're working on rendering.
Yeah, it's a really, really great presentation. A lot of great tools for designers specifically. A lot of, the VR tools and all those other things that are really, really great to have. Another little announcements we have, or maybe not so little, I guess people are really taking to it, is the new benchmark tool that we have out there.
Yeah, it's perfect timing. I mean, there's a lot of buzz around people trying to check out the latest NVIDIA cards, also the new Ryzen AMD processors. And so, you know, there's, plus we always get questions, especially at the labs, right? People want, people want to know, what hardware should I invest in? What makes it faster? And because we're CPU and GPU, we get multitudes of those types of questions. And it's nice to be able to have the benchmark or the first version of the benchmark out there.
Right. It's still very early. There's obviously going to be another one. We sort of threw it out there and said, see what people think of it and see how they like it and hear they're doing it. But there's already a ton of results. If you guys want to go check out the results, just go to benchmark.chaosgroup.com. If you want to try it out yourself, just go to chaosgroup.com, register on there, and just go to download section, and it's right there as V-Ray benchmark. You don't need a license of V-Ray to run it. You just run it. It runs off anything. I mean, it runs off a Windows machine. I should note that. It does not work in Linux. Or
Are you still in the leaderboard there with the GP100?
No, I was not. I was kicked off the leaderboard by Tomas over at DeBarty.
All right.
Because he has the new 1080 Ti's and he's using four of them. I just want to say that I'm only 3 seconds behind and I'm only using two cards. So yeah, but the GP100 is not really a fair fight because they're not actually released yet.
Right.
So it's not not fair. But anyway, there's a lot of great stuff out there, a lot of really great information. There's some amazing results and a lot of stuff that you can learn. So go ahead and check your stats out and see how well you fare. It's actually just kind of a fun test to do on your own. All right, guys, that's about it. Hopefully you guys will enjoy this really great podcast with our friends over at Steel Blue.
Welcome to another CG Garage where the Chaos Group talks. You'll know it's over when the last bucket drops. We're gonna fire off rays in high dynamic range. We know that ambient occlusion is passe. Global illumination won't lead you astray. And while image-based lighting is really swell, you need to make sure everything has Fresnel.
So how you guys been?
Great.
Good.
Doing good.
Doing well.
Yeah. Hold on. I got all tangled here. I'm going to do this.
Yeah, you don't need a badge to hang out here.
So, I don't need a GDC badge to do a podcast. I had a couple of things I want to talk about with you guys. Because you guys do, how long have you guys been around now?
About 9 years, since 2008.
9 years. Okay, so that's a good long amount of time. And you started how many people in the company?
One.
One. And how many since then?
We're about 24, 25 people right now.
Okay. That's a good size company for ArcViz, especially in the area. And you guys are obviously have seen over the last 9 years a lot of changes, probably, I'm assuming, in terms of what people want to see or how people want to see architecture in a lot of ways. So what do you think are some of the biggest changes you've seen over 9 years?
Well, I think we've all been in the industry a bit longer than 9 years, so I think that we've also had the experience to actually kind of look back and see wherever we were in our lives, some of the changes that have happened in different markets. San Francisco is an interesting animal because, the development here is so fast paced and the projects in scale are getting larger and larger that the budgets are increasing. Whenever the budgets increase, you get to see people trying new things and actually, not going with the old standbys, but actually, evolving the technologies. You know, when you go to sell a great idea or a really fun idea, mm-hmm. people are more apt to say yes. And so I think by doing that, you're getting people that are really a lot more open to exploring different creative endeavors.
Okay.
When it comes to kind of the application of visualization, mm-hmm. which means that storylines and how to tell those have evolved. People are more into storytelling than just, hey, let's get a bunch of renderings or let's go print this book. It's like we have these stories, there's language that goes with them. There's, the film work, I think, has gotten a lot more story-based than just the typical fly-throughs. We've been seeing that evolve over the years, but mm-hmm. Whether it's character-based or even things that are a little bit deeper, involved with the meaning of a building or a project. And then all the way up, through VR, where you're actually, really now we're talking about immersing people in environments and it's actually happening now. And so right. I think that's kind of tends to be where we're at and kind of that evolution, but that storytelling evolution has really been taken seriously.
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, obviously I was doing, you know, architecture visualization a couple of lifetimes ago, and I was always fighting the idea of people just setting up a camera with 1,000 frames and doing a walkthrough of a building is horrible. And I think that things have changed, obviously, since then. But you were talking about specifically storytelling, right? And I think it's really interesting because the idea of story in architecture is something that people don't necessarily realize or understand that. Architects tell stories almost unconsciously, right? Like when you were in architecture school, I don't know how many of you guys were in architecture school, but it was, you had to present your project, and by doing so, you're telling a story about your project, right? And so I think that's what you guys are doing, in a sense, is you're creating a narrative of the space, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, and the tools change in terms of, they evolve. What tools we're going to use to tell the story? Mm-hmm. I mean, there's been a lot of talk about the VR and the 360s, but QTVR has been around 23 years or something like that. Yeah. And the notion of have a 360-degree rendering is nothing new. But right. Sort of how do you tell the story now is something that we're seeing sort of evolve. That people our clients are really more acceptable to. Let's take a look at another way to tell that story versus just setting up a camera and hitting render.
And I was actually thinking about this today. Is like it's less about one thing, but those people, those artists, companies like ours, when you can connect the dots, it's like we have all these tools in our mm-hmm. tool chest. When you can figure out how to connect those dots in ways that are meaningful and those ways that are interesting, it's not creating something new. It's just a new way of looking at things. And so it's not, we all have the same tools. So everybody's doing bang up renderings these days and making great films and doing mm-hmm. really good VR stuff. But how are you doing it, and how are you engaging the person at the end? Because at the end, the way someone's going to experience it, that's where the rubber meets the road, right? You've got to turn them on somehow. And I think, in our world, there's two things that have happened that I think have kind of made this confluence of storytelling and ArcViz like really work out well, is that one, there's so much content out there these days that people are seeing so much animated, high production value content, whether it's on Twitter or Facebook or, just some random website, that where you, the level's been up, right? You've got to create things better. You've got to be better at storytelling. And then also, real estate buildings are like the story of our lives. We're so used to going in and out of them. I feel like ArcViz was kind of left on the sideline when it came to storytelling, because it's so mundane to a lot of people, but it shouldn't be, and it doesn't have to be. And I think that's where, when that was finally realized, that like, wait a minute, these are incredible assets that are going to be here for a very, very long time. It's a mark on the world. Mm-hmm. That's huge. That's bigger than a shoe or a car, or you know what I mean? But they pour millions of dollars into marketing those things. And so I think when you
actually, a lot of movies that got forgotten after a couple of months, right? They put $100 million into that.
Yeah, exactly. So when you think about the real mark that architects and developers are making in the world, mm-hmm. It's crazy to me that it's taken us so long to actually get to this point, in the level of quality we choose to represent it with.
Well, let's help clarify a little bit, because I have a wide variety of people that listen to this. So you guys are, what we call it, one of the top level architecture visualization companies out there. But you're not necessarily always approached by architects. In fact, probably not as much as like developers are probably your main customer, am I right?
Yeah, developers are our primary
customers. And realtors as well, right? So architects do their design portion, and then you take what the architects do and tell the story that the developer or the real estate company wants to tell. Is that a fair assessment?
Yeah, that's a fair assessment. I think one of the other things that we do is fill gaps where there is not design available, that we are the designers. You had asked, you had mentioned earlier, I don't know if we have architecture backgrounds. The majority of the team does.
Right.
And we do.
I assume so.
but I think more than just being able to understand plans and sections and how that sort of evolves into a building, but mm-hmm. being able to make design decisions that help tell stories for developers where the architects have not sort of gotten to that point.
Okay. And so how does that affect the architects when they see those decisions being made? I'm just curious.
In many cases, the architect, it's not the architect's job to do that.
It's not his responsibility.
You know? Okay. So the architect developing a 500,000 square foot office building, they're not designing the interiors. But to make a tenant fall in love with these interiors, you build out test fits. And so,
gotcha.
So a lot of those decisions need to be made. And there's sort of varying levels of quality and sort of design decisions that are made. There's sort of just taking a bunch of library of objects and putting it in there and say that's an office building, or
right.
You know, sort of really sort of going through and trying to imagine who it is that's using this and how they're using it.
Yeah. And what do you guys see as, I mean, you guys are mentioning that people want to see more story. Give me an example of a story. Like maybe you can use one of your projects and tell people like how that story evolved in one of these projects.
Well, you know, one of the more recent projects we've done is work on the San Francisco Ferry Building here in San Francisco, which obviously is arguably the most iconic project here in San Francisco. I mean, so many eyeballs and footsteps go through there for the market and also for travel. So when we were tapped to come up with a way to market some of the commercial real estate space in that building that not even a lot of people know exists in that building. It was really an interesting challenge to communicate something everybody already knew or thought they knew. And it all exists too, but a lot of the marketing was going to go to people outside of San Francisco. And of course they know the Ferry Building, but they don't know the nuances of the Ferry Building. So we actually ended up literally creating a story out of about 10 different panos that you would look at through a headset that would take you literally from the air, looking at this beautiful shot of San Francisco Bay Area where you can look all the way around. And you start this tour where you go down into the building and then you go from one pano to the next, or you can go back, and it's all narrated. And this was kind of the big kind of switch, which was having a voiceover walk you through something so that it was really kind of hands-off. You didn't have to wonder where you were. And it's literal storytelling. Somebody's telling you a story in your ear while you're looking at these beautiful panos. And I think that, however literal of an application, was a really interesting way to remind people about this icon. So it has to do, and we're going back and we're thinking about like, what does it really mean to be an icon, you know? And so when we're going back there, and we had to render all these new spaces into this classic, you know, building. And so it was to create this story around, again, the most tremendous icon in San Francisco, and what it means for a new company to be there. What is, you know, what does it mean? And then what does it look like for your company to be there? And so to try to kind of take people through this evolution of how you enter your building all the way through, you know, kind of more cerebrally what it means to be, you know, in the most visible place in San Francisco was pretty interesting, I think, from a storytelling standpoint.
Yeah, and I think the interesting thing is that every project has their own story to tell. And sort of that was one of our mission, is to sort of dig deep into a project's purpose. And, you know, who's going to live here? Who's going to work here? And so every project of ours has a different spin on it, has a different story. And so something for sort of a residential sort of high-end condo, we want to know, what does this person wear? What do they like to listen to? Where are they going to go at night? And, you know, sort of how do you stage that lifestyle in imagery or virtual reality?
Well, I think it's interesting because, I mean, you guys probably storyboard all these things yourselves, right? You guys come up with, did you guys write the script? Or did you have a writer write the script? Or did you guys work with a developer for that? Or like all of these things are sound like a full-on production.
Yeah, they can be. I mean, we are a small studio, but we all have different, you know, strengths that we bring to the team. And so a lot of times it's collaborating internally as far as like writing and things like that. There's a tremendous amount of information you can get from clients when you have them sit down and just start spewing everything that they need, everything they want to say.
Yeah.
You have to wordsmith it. So it ends up being, I think, less writing from scratch and more wordsmithing things that you've heard, making sure they sound euphonious, making sure they're getting everything in there. So I think it's just, you know, having done it a few times with story development for films, it's a very interesting application to get that into the VR world, knowing that it's nonlinear and knowing that you can move around. That's pretty cool.
Let's go there. Let's talk about that, because this is an important thing, and I've been talking about on my podcast ad nauseum, but I think that you're the perfect people to sort of discuss this. I think a lot of people are trying to shoehorn narrative into VR, and they're not necessarily doing it the right way. They're trying to use traditional filmmaking tools to make a VR experience somehow. And I don't necessarily find that as interesting. But I think, just based on what you said, like, architecture is a narrative, but it's non-linear narrative. And I think that is an interesting point. So how do you deal with the non-linear narrative part of VR? Like, what, give me an example of some of the things that are different from traditional narrative.
That's a very, very big question.
Yeah, it is. Well, it's, you know, it's interesting that it is very nonlinear. You have the ability to go everywhere in sort of virtual reality.
Right.
You know, but you don't necessarily want everyone to go anywhere. You still want to curate this. You still want to take somebody from A to B as if you're walking them through and you're directing their attention. Mm-hmm. I'm physically with you in this building and I'm going to point out this detail over here. And now I'm going to shuffle you over here. And mm-hmm. and whereas, you know, you have that ability to navigate, mm-hmm. it's still curated. And we don't sort of let people just wander off anywhere or see anything. It is linear, even though you have this sort of 6 degrees of freedom. We still try and captures people's attention in a certain way.
Now, how do you do that?
Well, I mean, in the ferry building instance, we tried it where you had the ability to go everywhere, and people did and ran around and didn't see everything, mm-hmm. or didn't see everything we wanted them to see,
or got lost.
Yeah. We sort of tightened the reins and said, you're going to follow sort of this trajectory, and this is the ability that we're giving you, so that we're allowing you to understand the space, you know, with freedom, but with right. constraints.
And so how do you make that path? Like, how do you say, I mean, is it like, do you feel that, like, you know, it's riding on rails, or do you feel it's like, here are a series of stops that you should make, or is it, you know, like,
it's more the series of stops.
It's and like a museum tour almost.
It's like a museum tour, and making sure that where you're going and where you came from are both almost still visible. When you go somewhere and you teleport too far, you know, you end up somewhere too far, it can be disconcerting or a little confusing as to where you are. So not making the stops too far away, I think, was something that, I mean, the ferry building's not that big, so we didn't have too much of a choice with that. But when given the option to make a choice, you know, when you've just got a dot, you know, a hotspot, let's say, placed on a wall, mm-hmm. and you don't know where that wall, what's on the other side of that wall, and you transport over there, you may get a little disoriented. And so I think that kind of line of sight thing does help, or at least close to it. Mm-hmm. helps get you there. And then also the design of the spaces. You know, we worked on the Pacific here in San Francisco, which is some of the highest end luxury condominiums that have ever been for sale in the city. Mm-hmm. And, you know, how that design laid out, how the space is laid out to where, you know, when you compose a rendering, the way that you put the furniture or the lighting or how everything works together sure. focuses your attention. And it's like that with a rendering or a hand and oil painting or any sort of visual representation. You want to focus on perspective and lighting and color and mm-hmm. and brightness and contrast. And so when you do that, you can do the same thing in panos, and that can help, again, direct your attention to where you should be looking, not at the wall with the painting necessarily right next to you, but look down that hallway. Maybe there's something down there. And so I think by being very careful, you know, with all of our gestalt principles, you know, to actually sure. focus attention is a big thing in design for the interiors a lot mm-hmm. of times.
Yeah, well, there's a lot of, we're talking about an 8,000 square foot penthouse or a 100,000 square foot floor plate in an mm-hmm. office building, or right. we're talking about nodes of panos versus using something like the Vive and Unreal, where you can sort of go anywhere. There's a lot of different ways to tell story, and there's a lot of different, you know, there's no one answer that fits all, you know. Okay. So it changes.
Yeah. Now, are you seeing trends that are becoming more common now, or is like everyone just kind of experimenting in lots of different ways?
I think there's a lot of experimenting, but there's also some, you know, the low hanging fruit where now I'm just sticking a 360-degree rendering in a Gear VR headset and call that VR and call it a day. Uh-huh. I'm seeing a lot more of that now.
Okay.
But it's in its infancy, and I think everybody's sort of just is researching and scratching the surface. And what else can it do outside of be a visual storyteller? I mean, what's great is you get to experience spatially what's happening around you.
But I still think, I mean, like, the jump to 360 VRs, and I'm not talking about just 360 mono, but 360 stereo VRs, where you actually get to see scale, was such an easy low-hanging fruit, but immensely changed, I think, the way that architects look at things now. I mean, don't you guys agree? I mean, it's like, that is so much more informative than a 2D rendering.
It is.
Yeah.
When you can get the people to wear them,
So, okay, all right. So that's a good question. Yeah. So it is when you would get people to wear them, right? So is that a challenge?
It's amazing. We were, I mean, part of the reason why it took us a bit to adopt, because we don't really like to use technology for the sake of using technology. There's got to be an application for it. We were concerned that it was a little gimmicky at the beginning. Mm-hmm. And so we tried out a bunch of things. And we have a lot of different age people, a lot of, you know, that we would come and try it out. Do the younger folks like them? Do the older folks like them? And it was kind of amazing because it's kind of all over the place. It really has to do, it's kind of a personal preference. Mm-hmm. We, you know, some people just don't like putting things in their heads, period. They don't like, if they feel claustrophobic when it's on or something. Other like people just are like kids in a candy store. They put it on, their jaw drops, and they just don't want to take it off. So I think it's been more readily adopted than I expected, personally. But I think people are getting more and more used to that.
It's still an education process. Yeah. Okay. We'll go to an event, and we'll, all right, here's five sort of devices, and get in line, and there's a queue, and we'll ask, you know, have you experienced this, as we walk them through? And I'm still finding 85-90% of people at these events have never tried it. And
never tried any VR.
Any VR. Anyway, the Gear VR is the most amazing thing, and saying, I didn't know these existed. Right. And it's surprising that that's still the case. Mm. And I think as more people use it and get educated on sort of how it works, then that goes away.
I see. Because, all right, so I was at GDC, that's a huge, huge thing. Obviously, there's a ton of people, a lot of booths and a lot of stuff. I would say almost half the booths have some kind of a VR content on them. And everyone has a line. And they're not as long because luckily there's a ton of things, but you can only experience this one at a time. Everyone's putting it on one at a time, and then you got to wait. You know, it's not like you can go into theater with 100 people and all see the same thing and walk out, right? It's one person at a time.
Well, we'll get there.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. Yeah. But I don't, you know, the market's also, in terms of, and I don't think this is true for you guys at all, but I think the market is not really adopted VR. You know, they thought that the Sony PlayStation VR was going to be huge, and it's like, meh, you know?
I can see. I see one of the challenges being some of the people sort of come in and try it on is that it's sort of an isolating experience to an extent. So you have you have one person in the headset, and they're having this amazing experience, but they can't share it, right, with whoever's next to them. So you can kind of look at it on a TV.
But you see, for architecture, I don't think that's the issue, right? You put it on, you're like, this is what it's going to look like, right? It serves the immediate function of what VR is about, taking you to a space that doesn't exist or you haven't experienced or whatever, right? So I think the architecture VR thing is really, really important. Here's my weird motivation. If the architecture world embraces VR or does embrace VR, and it's doing it because out of almost necessity, right? Because it's like, it's a tool that's important. It's not a gimmick. I really don't think it's a gimmick. I think it's an important thing that you guys are doing because that's how people want to, oh, this is what it's going to look like. I mean, a lot of people can look at a rendering and still don't understand what it looks like, right? I'm sure you guys know that. But when you put a headset on, it's like, oh, right? There's that enlightening feeling. And then after the guys who've never experienced VR and they apprehensive and they get over the awesomeness of the VR experience, and then they actually look at what they're really looking like, then they can like say, oh, I didn't know that window was going to be there, or I don't know. So I think that there's some, because of architecture's importance in VR, I think that the architecture should be helping the VR world, or an architecture visualization should be helping the VR world to understand how to use VR properly. I think that that would be great for you guys to be able to participate in that conversation in some way, because I think that's an important thing.
Yeah, and I don't think it's gimmicky. I think it's going to get used in different ways, whether you are an architect designing the space and you're in the VR sort of, so you understand spatially, or if you're in a sales center and you're trying to communicate a design and material options or what your views are going to be like to a potential buyer. You know, they're very different tool sets.
Both are very, like, immediately you know why you're using that, right? You're not putting on a VR headset to experience some random movie. That's the problem I have. Yeah. Like, there's a lot of dollars going in VR of like, I'm going to make some movie about something. And I was like,
or some weird game.
Yeah. And they all tech demos, right? Like, yeah. In VR, like, for architecture, I'm putting this on. It's like, all right, yes, I will buy this. No, you know what? I don't like that option. I like this option in the sales center. Totally get it. Or an architect puts it on. It's like, oh, no, that windowsill is way lower than I thought it was. Better to catch it now before it's in the construction phase, right?
Well, and you had, you know, something you brought up, Chris, was very interesting that, you know, that the things that we've learned, I mean, like little things that we were just talking about, like, you know, how high the camera is compared to, you know, how tall you're used to standing, so that the way scale feels is super important when you're next to things and the distortion and kind of what happens. All these little things can really skew your perception of a space.
Absolutely.
Like, we had this camera that was a little bit short, you know, it was 4'3" or so. We put it on and all of a sudden you're this little person and it's like you kind of squat down. You're like, whoa, this is, you know, it's very interesting. And it's, there's a lot of nuances, I think, that come technically in order to figure out how to do it. We can make it look really pretty, but the kind of the tactical ways of getting through the world in a VR experience is very interesting.
You know what was interesting? My first VR experience was with the first generation DK1, I guess, of the Oculus, and they put me inside of one of the famous games. I forgot what it was, but I was in it and I was looking around. But they had the height set towards like a normal, and I'm a kind of a taller guy, right? Mm-hmm. So I had the height set for like a normal average size person. And I felt like I was walking on my shins. Like it was, I could see the floor look too close. And even though I didn't even see my feet, I could sense that my things were too short. And I was really fascinated by that. I was like, they really got to solve this because I don't see the world this way, right? Mm-hmm. And then the other thing I saw, which was, I don't know how they did it really. Did you guys see the IKEA VR experience? Have you done that?
Yeah, and they let you actually drop down as a kid's perspective. So that you can sort of walk around, which is interesting.
But which was great. But when I did that, I didn't feel like I was chopped down because they didn't just move the camera down. They scaled the world up. So then it was... And you also start realizing how scary it is in a kitchen when you're a kid and you're trying to open a drawer that's like, you know, higher than you are.
Right.
Right. And then I put him in that VR experience, and then you can make someone 2 meters, which is like 6'6" or whatever. And he's like, whoa, he was freaking out. It's like, this is too high. You know, I'm like, so I think it's really interesting to think about like how you can learn, like learning, you know, if you, for example, right, you guys could make a children's museum and then do an entire VR experience from the height of a kid, right? It would be really awesome. And I think that's an important thing. I think that those types of education is really cool. All right, I'm going to get off VR for a little bit and talk a little bit about, we were mentioning just before we recorded it, you guys have been experimenting with some real-time solutions as well for a while now, right? Probably.
Yeah, I mean, you DK1, DK2, even before that, we've been.
Real-time games like Unity or Unreal.
Yes.
Or, yeah. So you've been doing it on in VR or just like, or for just overall walkthroughs or.
Mostly VR is when we really started getting into Unreal and Unity. I mean, we use Unity for other kind of programming, but less of real-time navigation.
Okay.
Primarily with VR is when we started really getting into it.
And what was the necessity of moving to those solutions? Is it because there was no real way to do pre-rendered content at the time or?
Out of interest. I mean, the technology, the tools have been advancing, and it's only become recent that we thought it was useful enough to roll out. Mm-hmm. You know, we've got boxes full of the different devices that, you know, these were never good enough, and it wasn't until I think probably a little over 2 years ago, we actually put it started putting it in clients' hands.
Okay.
But even before, say, using Unreal, we were pre-rendering 360-degree animations so that you have this, you know, sort of ability to sort of look around as you move through space.
Right.
And, which was sort of a cheat, but you could get the visual quality.
Well, not necessarily a cheat. I mean, it's just... you're riding on rails, right?
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
But you're also, I mean, okay. Do you feel that what you were getting in the real-time engines was as good quality-wise as what you're getting in the renderings before?
Not yet. There's still limitations.
Okay. What are those limitations?
Reflective properties and right. transparency and refraction and that sort of limit is. I mean, and then when you get into really large spaces or being able to move through cities and mm-hmm. you know, sort of you run up against limits with graphics cards.
Right. So, okay, but obviously there's a scale problem. There's a lot of stuff that you can throw at it. So the argument I've been making is that I think real-time engines are very, very interesting. And this is something that we're looking into as well. A lot of people seem to think that real-time solutions will eventually just kill off offline rendering. And that's correct, because I think that... But I don't necessarily think that rasterized rendering is going to kill off ray tracing mm-hmm. because of the same. And I think that architecture is a good example of that because you need things that ray tracers offer, right? Like reflections, refraction, and true global illumination, right? I mean, this is something that in our world. I mean, one of the things I always said is that architecture and architecture visualization probably revolutionized computer graphics without knowing it. And the way that they did that was in the 90s when they started embracing looking at global illumination mm-hmm. before anyone. And I don't think that that's going to be achievable through a rasterized engine. So... How are you guys, what are you guys looking forward to or seeing in the future when you're doing real? Because I think the idea of waiting for rendering, I don't want that to happen anymore either. I'm with you guys, right? Well, first of all, you don't want to, it's boring to wait. But also, like, in VR, you need to be able to move around a lot more. You need more freedom, right? You don't want to do that.
Yeah, I would say it's the thing we're looking forward to is like the ability to have someone in the environment and then be able to have those the light, the calculation, the reflection, the refraction influence the design as someone's sort of in it, mm-hmm. and then be able to manipulate it while you're in there, so you can start to feel it. You know, you have architects and designers making decisions and sort of rules of thumb. Mm-hmm. You know, I know that, you know, I'm going to get 40% sort of light from this sort of time of year, and I'm going to tilt my window this direction. Mm-hmm. But it'd be good to have not only global illumination, reflection, refraction, but be able to connect some sort of data set, some sort of interesting information that says this is sort of based on calculations, the right angle for the window to sort of let this amount of light in. Oh. At this geography, at this CIE file, you know, it's got more information in the decision-making process earlier instead of just kind of, I know this is a rule of thumb as an architect, but okay. actually having some sort of data input that helps you make those decisions in an informed kind of way. And then without becoming interrupted while you're doing that, you know, you're
right.
You're not being interrupted by a render error or whatever it is that sort of takes you out of that sort of state of design flow or creation flow or marketing, you know, creativity. It's sort of letting the tool fall away, like you said.
Okay. That's another great point. I think one of the biggest limitations of the older days when you had to wait a long time for renders is you didn't iterate as much, right? So you're talking about not just iterating every minute, but continuously iterating, right? So almost infinitesimally, like constantly moving things and seeing happen in real time. So not just go that and then wait that
Which is scary too, right? Because I mean, the
don't be afraid, Eric.
The party line has always been, you know, hey, when a client wants to make changes, okay, well, that's going, you know, it's going to take some time because we have to go make the change, then render the change, and then put the change in and do this. And so when it starts happening real time, you know,
the expectation goes way up.
The expectation, yeah, absolutely. And so, you know, it's like, oh, all you guys have to do is do this. All you have to do is do what? Yeah, and so I think we have to be careful about how much we we allow that to drive the process. But I think like what Mike's saying is there's so many decisions that could be made so much faster and get projects moving along faster. And just, you know, if we're not waiting around for things to bake, you know, and that's, I think that's a huge advantage. I would agree with
that. Yeah. And I think a lot of what we would, what everybody's talking about is visual fidelity and, you know, but the manipulation that, that Mike mentioned, I think is more interesting. I mean, the visual fidelity, it's coming, you know, it's going to be great, and you're going to sort of look the same as if you just cooked out a 4-hour rendering, but it's happening in real time. But you know, the ability to sort of interact with the objects and see multiple options, design options, or what is my view from this floor, from this floor, now day, now night, now you know, sort of being able to do all that on the fly becomes very interesting.
Yeah. Yeah, I almost wonder if people get so used to being able to change things all the time, they're actually going to change the designs of the building so you can do it on the building itself. but okay, so here's another analogy I think that mimics a lot of what you said, and this is a conversation I had with an old supervisor of mine who was on iRobot, and he was a DP, so he used to work on set, and he did miniatures and all that other stuff, and so he knew a lot about cinematography, but he wanted to know the process with which we were lighting things. So I was like, sit me down and show me how rendering works. And this is a long time ago, iRobot, right? Mm. And after he says, this is insane. He goes, that'd be like me going on set and basically turning off all the lights, placing them out in space, and then going in and turning them on and then waiting 10 minutes for them to heat up. And go, nope, and then turning them off, going back, and then moving the lights to the new position, and then going back up, turning it back on, and waiting 10 minutes for it to heat up. It's like, yeah, I mean.
It's antiquated, right? I mean, it makes no sense when you think about it like that, except that, you know, we've been obviously, you know, hamstrung by horsepower or hamstrung by, you know. And so now that that's obviously getting faster and faster.
Things are getting faster and faster, and it's right now the power is almost there. It's just expensive, but it's getting cheaper every day, right? Because like now, I mean, what they just announced yesterday, the new 1080 Ti is probably going to be as fast as the Titan X. Well, that Titan Ti, that's $600, right? A GPU from 2 years ago was $6,000. And probably was not as fast, right? Mm-hmm. So those computers are just going to get faster and faster. The GPUs are going to get faster to the point where it's just going to be readily available. Then on top of that, I think that on-demand cloud computing is also going to change. Are you guys exploring cloud computing at all or not yet? A little bit?
Yeah.
Yeah? Mm-hmm. So.
Yeah. I mean, we're doing a lot of our stuff on Amazon. If we need a lot of render power, we have an image that we set up, and then we'll deploy however many number we sort of need,
on
a kind of as needed basis, and then use that to do longer animations.
And that puts a lot of less stress on your farm, right?
To a certain extent, it's a bit still early, I think, and so it's not as sort of plug and play. It'd be ideal if we were able to render the same way we are inside our office as we are on the cloud. It just takes some more prep work and make sure
maps. I mean, it's bandwidth. It's pushing data through a pipe. And that's the only thing. And
so that's your only limitation. Yeah. Like, you're not going to throw Amazon out there if you only got a couple renders to do. But interesting. Okay. Well, so we talked about the real-time stuff and we talked about some of the other things. What are some of the other pieces of technology that you guys have seen grow over time?
Physical models.
Okay, you guys are printing.
Talk about taking it back.
Right.
It's really interesting. Well, and I bring this up because it's
they're not big dumb models, as we call them. You know, they're not these, what did you call them? The BDMs, you know, where, you know, these new 3D printed models, when we can use these in ways, and we're seeing this in a lot of, you know, marketing environments, is when you can use this technology, again, connecting the dots combined mm-hmm. with visual technology, combined with VR. Mm-hmm. But there's still something really cool and visceral about having, you know, something you can walk around and look at, which is kind of interesting. So the 3D printing is something we kind of stumbled into and have had a lot of fun doing and learned a lot, I think. But it's also proven to be a valuable piece of technology because these things can change easier and faster. And so just to get out of the digital for a minute and get to the practical, mm-hmm. You know, one of the you know, barriers for these models is that when things change, you had to tear them apart and they're all gluey and messy and mm-hmm. it kind of sucked. And now we can just print a new block or a new building, plop that in, your model's up to date. And so I think that kind of stuff is, I actually really enjoy that.
Just another storytelling tool.
Yeah.
And then you start to combine them, you know, the projection mapping or augmented reality in conjunction with your 3D printed right. model. There's a lot of different ways you can sort of merge these technologies together so that they're no longer BDMs. they're smart models. And yeah, I can touch that printed model over there and it's gonna give me some information.
Right. Well, I think that I always notice whenever, you know, if I'm back a long time ago when I was at Gensler, but, you know, giving a presentation to a client, whatever, we can put beautiful renderings up on the wall, but there's one little crappy model on the table, they all gravitate towards that model, right? Every time.
Yeah.
It's like something physical. And it's interesting to see that, you know, how that works. But
Well, I think especially in our world, there's something about having a physical specimen, something to touch and hold. When you look at something on paper, it's still not real. Mm-hmm. You want a building to be real. You want a space to be real. And I think then just, you know, having an architectural mind, right? That three dimensionality, right. You just can't get from a rendering. I mean, it, you know, it's still a piece of paper at the end of the day. So I think in our world specifically, having that shiny physical object is, I think it'll always be the first thing people go to because right. it still happens.
Yeah, that's cool. I think they're great. I do like touching them, although I'm always a little scared.
That guy's getting beaten up over there.
Yeah, you should hold on to this guy.
That's a yeah. What, so how is this? Is that 3D printed? Did you guys do?
No,
that?
It's laser etched.
Laser etched, yeah. Right? Okay, looks pretty cool though. So that's heavy too. Well, I think that's a sort of a really interesting thing. Can you guys describe some of the more interesting projects? You mentioned the ferry building, but what some of the other interesting, cool projects that you guys have done?
They're all cool in their own right. But I mean, even say the Pacific, where we talked about the virtual reality. You know, there's some other things that we did with that. That were very interesting. You know, mm-hmm. just the suite of renderings that we did. We staged a photo shoot. We went down to LA and hired, you know, glamorous models wearing, you know, ridiculously $30,000 gown dresses, and it looks uh-huh. like these people are sort of dressed to the nines to go out to some gala and sort of introduce them into the renderings. And it was a sort of a unique set of images that wasn't just the I need to show what this is going to look like physically, right. but you know how you continue that story beyond that.
Mm-hmm. And you guys do a lot of stuff like that, right? You guys get up in helicopters probably on a regular basis.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things, we obviously are San Francisco based, and right. so you know, being able to go up regularly and kind of have up to date imagery and content and data about what's happening in the city. Not to mention that we know a lot of what's happening in the next 5-10 years, but mm-hmm. Yeah, flying helicopters for, you know, storytelling purposes in order to get that macro view of a place, especially mm-hmm. in a city as beautiful as San Francisco, it makes a lot of sense. Instead of trying to render a bunch of stuff, let's go photograph it and
right.
you know, project it back, you know, back onto a model, or just use the base photograph or mm-hmm. video to composite into.
Yeah, I was going to say we were up there doing photography for the stills. We're doing photogrammetry models, so we try and help ourselves sort of get involved earlier in the process of a project.
Okay,
when they're doing sort
how
of
how do you guys do your photogrammetry?
Everybody's trying to remember the name of the software.
Sort of uploaded hundreds of thousands of photos. Not hundreds of thousands.
Right.
Thousands
of photos. I know what you're talking about. Oh, why am I blanking on this? It's been a long night.
Skype jumpy.
Yeah.
But photogrammetry is something you guys are doing, obviously, as well. And photogrammetry is getting ridiculously good now.
It's pretty good.
Yeah. It's really becoming helpful for, you know,
it's not just making planes. It's getting, like, you could do photogrammetry of this brick wall and you'd get almost every brick and nook and cranny in there. It's kind of incredible.
Or entire cities.
Yeah. Or entire cities.
So for previs, it's incredibly beneficial. Fast.
And fast. And you guys can put all the textures on there and it's all perfect.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's kind of a big part. You know, that's a big part of our, you know, what we do is the photography, you know, the actual, like the photographs, whether it's capturing textures or doing people or that sort of stuff, you know, we do all of that ourselves in house here. And that's part of that storytelling. I think just getting back to that is being able to, you know, get the right people doing the right things in order to, you know, make sure that you get the right demographic and they're dressed properly and that sort of thing. It's all part of the storytelling, making sure they're lit properly so they integrate really well and getting the right green screen keys and, I don't know if that was off base. Well, you're talking about kind of the things that we do that I think are a little bit of an extra touch. I think that's a big part of it is we're very much coming from a photography side of things as well.
Right.
When we get involved with a project, it's usually the long haul. It's the residential development down the street that we've been involved with for about 4 years from before they broke ground to help them understand what their views will be in the future to doing films and interactive media and, you know, 4 dozen renderings to now the building's built and we're photographing all the stage units and we're creating film content for them. We, you know, created construction hoarding graphics that were set extensions basically as if you're walking down the sidewalk and it just continues forever rather than looking at sort of a big hole in the ground. And, and even photography that's become permanent installations in their building for rock climbing walls. And so we get involved and we've stayed involved as a sort of a marketing partner from you know for 4 years on that one project.
And all, you know, visually related. I think people think about visualization firms typically as just rendering stuff and you know, the applications of those rendering where you're going to experience it or even photography. Like it's all visual representations of things to communicate things faster and better. And so I think that when you think about visualization in that term, it kind of broadens the scope of what you can do. And I think it kind of opens your mind so that, you know, when you don't pigeonhole yourself into something smaller, you can really be a great asset to your clients. And that's what clients love, or they love good assets, you know.
Right.
They love to have a good renderer, a good photographer, a good web designer, all this. But when you can be something more than just any one of those things, I think you become a really valuable asset to the industry too, because you start thinking differently and maybe you develop something new, a new process or a new script or, you know, whatever it ends up being.
What do you think is going to be some of the new thing that you guys are going to stumble on or not so stumble on?
I got a call the other day that asked me if holograms are a real thing.
I get that call every week.
Like, what's
you can do it. I saw it in Star Wars. Come on. Why can't you do this for my project?
Holograms. That was the thing. We want to be able to have this thing just floating in front of everybody. And, it was just, and I love the way people are thinking, though. Like, that's the thing that's really cool is that, like, all VFX are done so well these days that I think a lot of people don't know that a lot of it doesn't exist yet, you know? And so it's really exciting. I think that people are asking for that. You know, I think that, again, not to use technology for the sake of using it, like we're just getting comfortable, I think, in the VR and learning how to make it valuable.
Right.
And I think that it's a process, you know, it's a process of education, like O'Brien said. And I think, you know, we're much further along than we were a year ago. And I think in another year we'll be even further along. So seeing where that goes is really interesting to me as far as that immersion. And I think where that comes into play is how do you share that with people? How do you have multiple people share an experience? And I think that's kind of the next evolution, like Mike was saying, of kind of the virtual reality immersion. Yeah, that's coming up.
Where it's interactive,
yeah.
Okay. That's a good,
You're sort of over to go experience this place, and it's more augmented reality instead of virtual reality. You can see the world around you change, and it becomes a layer on top as opposed to completely immersive. It would be compelling.
Did you see the thing that they were showing at GDC? It was Epic was doing a real-time rendered car, right? Mm-hmm. And they had an actual car that they removed the body on, and it just had tracking markers on it. And then so you could just put any car on there. and they would do this commercial, but it was all rendered in real time, and you could on the fly while the commercial was going change the color of the car, change this, change that. And look great. But you know, that's almost to the point of like, okay, now I just want my car to do that. Today I want a green car. Click.
Yeah.
So I think that's one of the things that I think is interesting is like when you give people that power of a tool, they almost want to use all the time. I don't know. You guys have a smartwatch at all? Like I got this smartwatch, right? And I was like, oh, wow, look, I was changing the face of it every day. You know, like look at that. I can do whatever I want. I can change it. I can change it. I can change it. And then I haven't changed it in a year and a half.
So now it's a watch?
Now it's a watch. Well, it still tells me things, but it hasn't changed in 2 years. It's like, I guess that you're right. Maybe that novelty wears off. It's like, this watch face does all the things I needed to do.
Yeah.
All right. Well, this has been really, really fun. I'd love to be able to share some of you guys' work and put it up there and let people see what it is. You know, get an idea of where you guys think, you know, what other things you're interested in, and explore those things and share those things with my listeners. That sound good?
Cool. Yeah. Thanks for having us.
Sounds good.
Thanks, guys.
Thanks a lot.